Shrink Wrap Radio number 506, Exploring the Medicinal and Spiritual Potential of Marijuana, with Barbara Harris.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is author and therapist Barbara Harris, and we'll be speaking about her book, The Secrets of Medicinal Marijuana, A Guide for Patients and Those Who Care for Them. For more information about Barbara Harris, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Before we go to the interview, let me mention that this week's featured article in The Neuropsychotherapist is Spirituality as Connectedness by Richard Hill, and you'll find it at neuropsychotherapist.com, which is the beautifully illustrated online monthly magazine for psychotherapists and anyone else interested in the intersection between the latest neuroscience findings and psychotherapy. I want you to go to neuropsychotherapist.com and get your free introductory issue today. And I'm hoping that will inspire you to support their superlative work by subscribing to it. Today's episode is also sponsored in part by Zipcar.com, where you can earn $25 of free driving credit by going to joinzipcar.com/shrinkwrapradio. And now, on to the interview. Barbara Harris, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's really a pleasure to have you here, and in part at least, in large part, it's due to longtime listener and transcriber Gloria Ullman in faraway Melbourne, Australia.
Yeah.
And she contacted me and kind of said, well, here's somebody that I'd really like you to interview. And if you do it, I'll even do the transcription. So I'm very grateful to her and to you for being here. And we're going to be discussing your recent book, Secrets of Medicinal Marijuana, a guide for patients and those who care for them.
Okay.
Yeah, and maybe you can hold it up. I know you've got a copy of the book there. Yes, that's what it looks like. It's in paperback. And I highly recommend it to people who are interested in this topic. And this is actually your 10th book.
Yes.
With earlier ones focusing on healing from repeated trauma, the emotional needs of critical care patients, and the integration of spiritual experiences. However, this book seems to go back to the beginning of your personal journey with trauma and recovery. So let's go back and begin with the traumatic accident that I believe happened when you were around 23 years of age.
Oh, 33 years of age. 2 years of conservative care, which back then and still is, opiates and Valium for 2 years.
Well, tell us about the accident itself. And
I got pushed into a swimming pool, which is not a smart thing for anybody to do. I was pushed in and my foot hooked on the side and my back snapped as I hit the water. And it felt like a whiplash in my lower spine. And the doctors for 2 years gave me Valium and escalating opiates all the time. And finally, after 2 years, we realized that the drugs weren't making me any better. And if anything, they were just numbing me out. So it was time for surgery. And I had what was supposed to be a 2-hour spinal fusion, turned out to be 5.5 hours. There was a lot more damage in my spine that they couldn't see on x-ray. And right after that, I started to die. This was not in the surgical suite. This was back in my bed, which, by the way, was a striker frame circle bed, a very awesome way to wake up from surgery. I couldn't move for a month. The bed moved me.
It rotates in the air somehow?
Yeah, it rotates me up and over onto my face 3 times a day to drain my lungs and air out my back.
And you were in that for 7 months, do I recall that correctly?
I was in a body cast for 7 months.
Okay.
I was in the circle bed for a month, and I couldn't move. And also, I was also an atheist. I was very bitter from a very abusive childhood. And somewhere the second night after surgery, I woke up out in the hallway. And the first thing I thought of was, if they catch me out here, I'm going to get into trouble. I better get back into that bed. And as I turned around and moved back into the room, I saw my body lying in the circle bed. And, I mean, this atheist had no idea what was going on. All I knew was I was out of pain, and I felt better than I had felt in years.
Wow.
Yeah, and then the next thing I knew, I was moving through a tunnel, and I spent I don't know how long with my grandmother, who had died 14 years earlier, and I had never dreamed of her existing beyond her death.
Now, so this was a near-death experience.
Yes.
And just before you told us about that, you said that you were dying. Was there some clinical correlation?
Yes.
What was happening in your body?
I was internally bleeding, and my blood volume was dropping, and my blood pressure was very, very low. I failed to say that a few minutes or maybe an hour before this happened, people started rushing in and throwing bottles over my head. This was before I became a respiratory therapist, so I had no idea what was going on. But they were hooking me up to all kinds of equipment, and that's the way I was living until I found myself out in the hall. And then it happened again a week later.
Another NDE or near-death experience. Tell us about that one.
Well, this is the one that completely changed my life, because what I did was I had the classic life review that Ken Ring wrote about. In fact, I'm in two of his books, Heading Toward Omega and Lessons from the Light.
I didn't catch the name. Who was that?
Kenneth Ring from the University.
Okay, yes, yes.
Yeah, so I became one of his subjects in his books. The life review was so profound, and it showed me the abuse I had been through, and I could just hear myself saying over and over again, no wonder, no wonder. And what I meant that, I think what that meant was, no wonder you are the way you are, because I was really neurotic and very insecure. Look at what was done to you when you were a child. I could see the abuse. And the other thing I saw, which was totally amazing, was myself as a child in the tunnel. I had not remembered that. But I would, after a beating, I would go into the tunnel and I would hang out there feeling really peaceful. And I also have to add that while I was going through this life review, which seemed to take 32 years, I was being held by this energy that for years I couldn't use the word God, but it was some kind of God force holding me. And I could see through its eyes and I could feel all this through its heart.
Yeah, in the book you describe a really tangible feeling of being held, as if being held by a very caring mother.
Yes, yes. And it wasn't just around me, it was in me too.
Uh-huh.
And every time I said my no wonders, it held me tighter and more lovingly. And all I could think of at the time was, this is pure love. This is pure love. And I saw some things that I wasn't very proud of either. And it still loved me. There was no judgment. I was doing the judging, but God wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
And so that had a profound rest of your life impact.
Well, I tried to put it away because I asked to see a psychiatrist. And this was back in 1975. And the psychiatrist had no idea what I was talking about. And he gave me antidepressants. So I brought the antidepressants home. And I looked at my counter in the bathroom, and there were 26 bottles.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, it was pathetic from 2 years. And about the same time, one of my wonderful friends, who just is a wonderful person, gave me a joint. And so I inhaled. I think I inhaled it twice. And by the end of the day, I had flushed all the pills down the toilet and threw the bottles away. I never wanted to renew anything. And, you know, it's pretty hard to stop opiates that suddenly, but most people should never do that. You need to be tapered. But for me, having had this spiritual experience and having a good marijuana or cannabis cigarette, I didn't need the pills anymore. I was trying to get the pills to lift me out of a 35-pound cast when I weighed 85 pounds. The cannabis did that immediately with no side effects. So I spent the rest of the 7 months on cannabis, not on prescription drugs.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask you what the connection was between the between all of this of the major trauma to your spine and then the near-death experiences, and then somehow marijuana gets into it.
Yeah.
So you move through that part very quickly of taking a couple of inhales and then getting rid of all your all of those medicines.
Yeah.
Well, did that take a little time? Was there a thought process around that? Had you been intending to wean yourself off? Tell us a little bit more about that.
Part of my suffering as a child was my mother was a prescription drug addict. My mother was always taking pain pills and Valium and sleeping pills and then drinking 8 cups of coffee a day trying to stay awake. And the last thing I saw in my life review was that I was becoming like my mother and that I would be doing the same thing to my children if I didn't stop.
Uh-huh.
So when I started lifting out of my drama because I was getting high, I realized that this was the answer I was praying for, that I could get off of all the pills and not be like my mother. And what happened after that, I'll just skip a little, was I became a respiratory therapist and I was doing home care for the dying. This was down in South Miami Beach.
Okay, and tell us what a respiratory therapist is, because I don't know.
What happened was I went back to the hospital where I had been and I volunteered and I was working in the emergency room and the staff caught on pretty fast that if somebody was dying in the emergency room or anywhere else in the hospital, they would ask me to go in and sit with them while they died. Because those of us that have had NDEs aren't afraid of dying anymore. In fact, to us, it's a privilege to help people transition. So from there, I started watching in the hospital to see what I would like to become. And the respiratory therapists, the nurses are stuck on their floor. The respiratory therapists are all over the hospital. And I wanted to get on the crash cart team. You know, that's when there's a code.
Yeah.
Okay. So while I was a volunteer and then while I was a student, they knew that if somebody was dying, I would go there and I would hold their hand and talk to them. So that's how I got involved in respiratory therapy. What happened was nobody was talking about this kind of stuff in the late 70s. So I was trying to, I was at Mount Sinai Medical Center on South Beach, and this was during the Mariel boat landing, and we were getting all these Cubans in that were suffering because they had lost relatives on the boat trip over, and some of them were dying, you know, and they were just brought in off the beach. But none of us could speak Spanish. Back then, there were no Spanish-speaking nurses anywhere on South Beach. So I started complaining about the way we were not helping people die, the way we were missing the boat, and I knew sooner or later I was going to get fired because I was just complaining. I could see what was wrong. So what I did was I quit and I started doing home care for the dying. And this was a wonderful period for me because sometimes both people in the couple were dying. So then you become a translator for them. Then you help them to finally get some kind of a conversation going because they're both angry that you promised me you were going to help me when I died, and now you're dying too, so you're not helping me.
Oh, wow.
I became a translator. And then if I could see that their prescription drugs were not helping them at all, that this was the first time I did this, I just asked a grandson that was there who was home from college, I said, is there any way that you could get your grandma some cannabis? I don't want to put you in a bad position, but do you know anybody? And he just looked at me and he said, I'll go to my car.
Right.
Every time I asked after that, people, especially young people, always had a way to get it quickly.
Now, were you worried about making that kind of recommendation that you might find yourself in some kind of legal trouble?
Well, I was very careful to never give it to them myself. Uh-huh. I was always careful to recommend it. And then just kind of, this was South Miami Beach in the late 70s and early 80s. There was marijuana everywhere. I remember an article in the local magazine on the Bee Gees, and the author of the article saying that there were little containers of joints everywhere to help yourself when you went to visit the Bee Gees. That was the mood. Mm-hmm. Back then. So I wasn't worried about it then. I'd certainly be worried about it now.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Make up their mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're much more careful now in terms of what you would do, even though there seems to be a movement, a really changing environment in terms of the whole legal environment in the U.S. And just yesterday, you sent me a link to, I guess it's a new organization of,
yes.
Tell us, yep. About the Physicians Against the Criminalization of Marijuana, something like that.
For cannabis reform. And it's a very, very prestigious list of 3.5 pages of physicians from some of the most prominent medical schools in the country. And my husband and I quickly joined because we're part of this movement. The thing is, we're being stopped by the pharmaceutical industry. They're the ones that are lobbying in Congress. They're the ones that want to stop this because they're making billions of dollars. And once cannabis is approved all over, people don't need to take these heavy-duty pills that give them side effects. Cannabis doesn't have many side effects, and cannabis, if used properly, that's why I wrote this book, if used properly, does not have any side effects at all. So yeah, we got involved right away when we heard about it.
Yeah, yeah. You make a distinction between recreational marijuana and medicinal marijuana.
Yeah.
Were you a recreational user before those two puffs that caused you to throw away all your medicines?
I would say I dabbled a little bit in the 60s.
Okay, you know, yeah.
But didn't stick with it because I was raising babies.
Uh-huh. Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but I was just in Colorado because one of our daughters lives there with her family. And I mean, we walked into a dispensary and I couldn't believe it. It was like walking into Mecca. You know, and they separate the recreational from the medicinal. So we were very, very interested in the difference. And there isn't much except the cost. You pay less if you have a license for marijuana from a doctor. Okay.
Yeah.
But I just lectured on a college campus. Some young people sponsored me in. And what we decided was the word recreational should not be used anymore. The word wellness should be used. And this is a lot of what my book is about too. Instead of getting goofy or inhaling yourself into a stupor, what we've learned is very little is better. If you look at a bell curve, you know, here's the first two hits and you're up here and you're able to really perceive what's going on. You continue and you're just going to go way down into a stupor, just like alcohol. Just like any drug.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. And that was the thing that was really most striking to me as someone who in the 60s, middle 60s through the middle 70s. And again, you know, recreational a little bit, but also it was part of a spiritual quest, I would say.
Absolutely.
Among the people that I hung out with. But it was also a very social thing. And as time has moved on, hit my microphone. The people that I hang out with, they're not doing it anymore. The whole social thing seems to have moved on for somewhere else for a certain segment of us. And so where was I going? But the small dosage thing, that really kind of struck me. I had a little bit of a aha because, back then it was like kind of smoke till you drop, so to speak.
And the kids at this university were so excited to hear that a little bit is better. And I explained to them what mindfulness is, mindfulness meditation.
Yeah.
And that doing it with just one or two inhales can really show them an expanded level of consciousness that they can keep. They don't have to be smoking all the time to be there here.
Yes.
We can do it now, you know. And there was something else I wanted to say about that, and it just went right through.
Yeah, it'll probably come back. That happens to me all the time. Now, you use the word medicinal throughout, and kind of what popular parlance, I think, has been is a lot of talk about medical marijuana. And so I'm wondering if there is a shade of difference to you between the term medical marijuana and medicinal marijuana.
No, I don't think there's any difference at all.
Okay.
the graphic artist who did the cover of the book liked the way that flowed. I would have calling it cannabis because, you know, that's the scientific name. And the word marijuana comes from Mexico. But we wanted that MM in there. And it could have been medical or it could have been medicinal. But I want the world to know that, and that's another reason why I wrote this book, that it can help us to stop being asleep. This is a wake-up. This is a wake-up medication, and I think this is one of the reasons why the government does not want us to have the ability to use it, because they want to keep us asleep, and this is definitely a wake-up call. And now I remember what I was going to say about it being a wake-up call. I met Sasha Shulgin at Esalen Institute in the early 80s. I was there for a small group that was discussing psychedelics being used for therapy. And do you know who Sasha Shulgin was?
That is a name that I've run across quite a bit in the whole hallucinogenic psychedelic movement.
Right.
And
right.
Is that the husband or the wife?
This is the husband, but she was there too, and I got to know both of them.
Okay, and he passed away recently, is that right?
Yes,
okay.
He did. And the small group that got together were mainly therapists of varying degrees who wanted to use MDMA in therapy. And, I mean, early 80s, MDMA was all over the place.
Yes.
Hadn't hit the raves yet with the kids. It was being used in the psychological community for a wonderful session where you could get to buried things without the pain. You could bring them up.
Yes.
And then later you could continue the therapy on what had happened in that session. So Sasha Shulgin and I were talking about that, and I asked him about cannabis. And he was the one, and this is in my book, he was the one who said, you hold the cannabis in your hand and you ask it if it can be MDMA, if you can do a session, and it will let you know almost immediately if it will. And then use that. You don't have to use the MDMA. Well, what a mind-blowing explanation he gave me. I was at the University of Connecticut. And I started telling the other researchers, try it like MDMA. We don't have to go into all those heavy side effects. And it worked.
Fascinating. This kind of verges into the discussion of set and setting, because you're talking about kind of coming to it with a certain mindset.
Right.
And in the book, you even talk about some fairly prayerful approach to it, letting it. So, communicating to the marijuana as much as to your own unconscious and so on, this is what I come to this in a respectful way, and this is what I need, and this is what I hope for.
Yes, yes. And to pray over it before you use it. I mean, you hold it in your hand, and you ask it what it can be, and you thank it, and you name it. You give it a new name. It's not cannabis anymore when it's prayed over. It's Santa Maria. It's the energy of Mary.
Ah, okay.
It's the Holy Mother. I mean, this is what I've gained from it.
Yes.
And the way it started for me was I'm Jewish, and on Friday night I light my Sabbath candles. And there was one time we were in Colorado. I lit my candles, and I inhaled. And I realized something was going on, so I asked it to be Santa Maria, and I declared that the next 24 hours, because that's our Sabbath from sundown on Friday to sundown on Saturday, I asked to have a shaman's Sabbath. Sabbath.
Sabbath, yes.
Sabbath,
yes.
Or if you're Jewish, Shabbos. Shaman's Shabbos.
Yeah, Shabbos.
And, I mean, for the next 24 hours, I was in a beautiful spiritual space. And I didn't have to continue smoking, by the way. I had just made the hookup. You know, it was like when I was a teenager and I worked in the office at the high school. I was on the phones, and we used to have the wires, and we'd stick them in the hole. That's what it felt like.
Lily Tom on the switchboard.
So, I mean, that's how I started to realize the spirituality of it. And then I was using it with some more dying people. And just between you and me, and I won't say where I was living at the time, a couple of them smoked at the very end of their life, like within the last 24 hours, and asked the people who they felt safe with, not the whole family, but the safe ones, to come in, and they did a ceremony around it. They passed it around, and they sat there surrounding the bed with laughter and tears and memories and well wishes, and I thought, this is just amazing.
It sounds beautiful.
Oh, and then when the person finally, the one I'm thinking of now, passed away, and the hospice nurse came to sign the papers, she said to me, "What has happened here?" She said, "I've been visiting this woman for months, and she says, I've never seen the family this cohesive." Well, I wound up writing a book around that story and 13 other stories of people I've helped die, and that's called Final Passage. Okay, and in many of these instances, I did not write it in the book because I was afraid, obviously, but there was cannabis used between the dying person and the family, and it was every one of those scenes was beautiful.
Well, it makes me want to look ahead a bit into the future and to imagine if the legal climate keeps changing, that maybe it could evolve to the place where cannabis shaman people such as yourself could help to facilitate that transition.
Yes.
And that's become a major part of what you do now, hasn't it? The helping people with the transition?
Well, no. I'm not doing that as I'm seeing individual patients, and my husband and I have psych groups. And our groups are members who have had repeated abuse in childhood, like I did, and most of them have a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. And the way we're using it here, because it's legal, is CBD drops. Have you heard about CBDs?
I have heard, but go ahead. Maybe not everybody has. Cannabidiol, is that?
Cannabidiol does not have enough THC in it to get you high. So the government has approved it. I think it went through the FDA. You can order it online. I mean, really? I get mine from the Stanley Brothers, who did Charlotte's Web without THC for states where it's not legal, and with THC where it is legal for children who are having repeated seizures.
I've seen major television specials on treatment for kids with seizures.
Yeah. But for the ones that have PTSD like me, listen, psychologically, I have been washed and ironed over and over again. You know, I have been in and out of therapy my whole life, plus going to all kinds of workshops, trying to get rid of this angst from my childhood. I think that mentally and emotionally, I've got it. But physically, my body, my autonomic nervous system still gets triggered easily. And then I'm walking around with all this adrenaline and cortisol. Well, those CBD drops, like 3 drops under my tongue in the morning and then again in the evening before I go to sleep, just mellows that out. Because we have something inside of our body called the endocannabinoid system. Remember a while ago when Candice Pert discovered the Valium receptor?
Sure. It's another name I've heard of. Yeah. And
she wrote a book called The Emotional Molecule. But we have something very similar that accepts cannabinoids. It's like a lock and a key.
Yep.
In our brain and our central nervous system more so, but then in other organs in our body. And what these cannabinoids do, and they don't have to have THC, but what they do is they unlock the lock, and what's produced has been named anandamide. Ananda meaning bliss.
Uh-huh.
Okay, where Valium turns off our emotion, CBDs turn on the bliss. That's why people get hooked on smoking, because they love the bliss.
Yeah. So you're saying that with those drops, you experience some degree of bliss, but not feeling high?
I think if you did it with THC, you would get more of the bliss. What I'm getting is a leveling out or a disappearance of the angst that came from the PTSD. Mm-hmm. And this is going on now with vets. The vets that have been diagnosed with PTSD, where it is legal, they are getting marijuana, cannabis, Where it's not, they're getting the CBD drops. Let me give you one example. Charlie and I last fall were in Findhorn in Scotland. You know,
Charlie is your husband?
Yes, Charles Whitfield, MD.
Okay.
And who wrote Healing the Child Within. And so he's been working with PTSD his whole career. Anyway, we're in Findhorn, Scotland, and I'm teaching at a conference. And I'm going to do a workshop after my original talk. And I am asked by the powers that be that in the second half of the workshop, I bring out this book and tell people about how to use cannabis. In Europe, it's easier to get if you're sick. Well, there was standing room only for my workshop because they let everybody know I was going to be talking about medicinal marijuana or cannabis. And more than half the people in the standing room only, there were close to 100 people, had terminal illnesses. Mm-hmm. And I started talking about how to use it. And some of them already had it. They were given it, but they didn't know how to use it right. Meanwhile, a vet came up to me after who has suffered horribly from post-traumatic stress disorder and told me that the VA is about to do a catheterization on his heart and actually cauterize a couple valves because his resting heart rate is up between 120 and 130.
I have a friend who's in that process.
Well, we hooked him up with somebody who had CBDs. And we sat at a table with him, and he took his heart rate, and it was 130, and he took two inhalations of the CBD drops in a vaporizer. This wasn't the drops. This was inhale. And I'll talk about vaporizers in a minute because that's important. Anyway, his heart rate went down to 65. And he's emailed us a few times since that it has not gone back, that he's using the CBD drops. So I got in touch with Roger Martin in Colorado, who has an organization called Grow for Vets. And what he's doing is the farmers that are growing the cannabis in Colorado donate a certain amount of their, whatever you call it, for him to then give to Vietnam, not all kinds of vets. And it's spread. He has spread now from Colorado to Washington State and the states down the Pacific line where it's legal. Anyway, I donated a box of my books, and he's giving them to the vets that can understand what my book's about because it's getting technical. So I'm just so thrilled to see how this works with the vets. We don't have to make them wait months and months and months for care, and we don't have to give them those harsh psychoactive drugs.
I hope somebody's doing some studies on some of these things that you're talking about.
Dr. Cicely. Yeah, I forgot her first name. She's an MD, and she's working with MAPS. Do you know about the organization MAPS?
Yes.
She was fired from, I think, the University of, I'm not sure, because of her wanting to research marijuana. And now she has gotten FDA approval, and she's working with PTSD and using cannabis. So, yeah. It's being done. You know, in Israel, they've been doing it for 40 years, and in Israel, it's totally legal. There's a one-hour YouTube documentary on this about the doctor who's been the lead for 40 years named Raphael Mechoulam. If you go to YouTube and you just type in the scientist, it'll come up. There's one scene that I absolutely love where we're in an old folks' home or a senior facility, and you see people on walkers and with canes and in wheelchairs going into a central room where they have a huge vaporizer. And each person has a balloon, and they put the balloon over the top of the vaporizer, and it fills with marijuana smoke. And they take it back with them, and they've got it all day. So instead of their insurance paying $1,000 a month for all these pills that give them all kinds of horrible effects, they're all high, and they're all happy.
I'm not surprised.
You got to see this.
The scientist, you say? Just the word, the scientist, on YouTube? I would think that would bring up tons of stuff.
Yeah, it does. I mean, watch it. It's worth it. Everybody should watch it, because everything that we're trying to do here has already been done in Israel. Raphael Mechoulam, Mechoulam, I think. Now, I got to get back to vaporizers, because I mentioned vaporizers.
Yes.
For people that want to use it the way I'm talking about, to expand their consciousness or for pain reduction or PTSD, You don't have to smoke it with a flame. That is going to hurt your throat eventually and your lungs. They've come out, it started with the e-cigarettes, you know how people are walking around with their nicotine.
Yeah.
Well, they've adapted it now for herbs, and they even have it for oils, because oils have become the really big thing. They last longer. And when you use a vaporizer, which looks like an e-cigarette, it doesn't get half as hot as burning it. Marijuana will burn at a much lower temperature. So if you use a vaporizer, you're saving your throat and your lungs, because you're not burning it into your body. You're inhaling it into your body.
What about dosage? And I know there's so many complicated variables here, because there are the different varieties of cannabis and the different modes of taking it in.
Right.
And for example, I know from my own experience and others, when it was cooked in brownies, you could get a very high dose and a very strong effect that you might not be prepared for.
Right.
So if you can, and I know you've got a page or two of kind of steps and recipes and effects and so on, take us through some of that, if you can, the highlights.
First of all, if you get it and it's manufactured and sold at a dispensary, I would not eat the whole thing right away. I would break it into quarters or even an eighth and eat a little bit, wait an hour. When you eat it, it takes an hour to 2 hours to take effect. So if you eat a quarter of a cookie, let's say, and after 20 minutes you're not getting anything, so you eat another quarter, you may, an hour after that, really hate that you did that.
Yeah.
You go slow, and when you eat it, it will last up to 8 hours. So when we were in Colorado, and I was at an excellent dispensary, the bud keeper there, who really knew a lot, and I would highly recommend, if it's legal in your state and you're going to go to a dispensary, interview the bud keeper, and if you feel like this person really knows what they're talking about, stay with them. If you don't, move on, because there are some people that are just salespeople, and then there are some people that really know their stuff. Mm-hmm. So I was really lucky to get somebody really good, and I told him I needed it for sleep and I had post-traumatic stress disorder, and he sold me these little tiny cookies that were mainly made out of seeds and nuts compressed with the dosage appropriate. And he told me, this was really cute, he said, take it 2 hours before bedtime. It'll take an hour for it to work, and then you'll have fun for an hour. You'll get to know it, and then you'll sleep for 7 hours straight. And I did. So
yeah, I always, back in the day, I had friends who would get sleepy, and then they'd go off and go to bed, and I guess they would sleep. I would get wired. I would just get so activated that I couldn't turn my brain off. And sometimes that was, I couldn't get to sleep.
There are two kinds. There's sativas, which are uppers, and this is all in my book. Yeah. And there are indicas, which are downers. Indicas are for sleep. Sativa is for energy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So people who are getting chemotherapy, let's say, who can't eat and who are lethargic, the sativa will help them to want to eat and will help them to get some energy. But let's say it's bedtime and they can't sleep. That's when they use the indica.
Okay, and then that's a good tip.
Then there are hybrids too. And what it is it's all experimentation. I think what I love the most about plant medicine is that instead of the doctor dictating to us what we're supposed to do, because he's the authority or she's the authority, and we're the one who just has to listen and leave, with this kind of medicine, you have to determine it for yourself. It's all experimentation. And after a few days, something that worked really well on the first day may not work on the fifth day. And then you have to go to another strain, do that one for a while until it's not working, and then maybe go back to the first one. So what's happening is we're taking control of our healing.
Yeah, and you even suggest keeping a journal, mm-hmm. much as a lab scientist would, of, okay, this is what I did, these were the conditions, here was my mental set, and kind of learning, because we're each different, and we react to medicines, both legal medicines and these plant substances in unique ways, matching our own biological and mental uniqueness.
At the back of the book, I have an empty chart where you can make a copy of it, or you can write in the book to keep an eye on which one is helping you more than another. And, you know, there's also ratios, and you learn about the ratios. I talk about it in the book. There's a lot of things. I want to get to set and setting before we're finished.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because that's really important. Remember the picture on TV of two sunny side up eggs in a frying pan?
Yeah.
And this is your brain.
This is your brain on drugs, yeah.
Well, perhaps on marijuana, this is your brain because you're going to be sunny side up. It's going to give you the oomph that you need to get out of your drama and fight the disease or give into the disease or whatever it is and at least have some happy times, okay? So this is your brain on marijuana. It is not a gateway drug. You will not want to go into heavier drugs. What you'll want to do is find some other happy people because you're feeling good for a change.
Okay, and this is a point where Gloria Ullman primed me with a question, and so I want to slip it in here. She asks, What about people who have an addictive personality? In other words, they have a history of just overdoing whatever it is they get into.
Yeah. Guess what? Marijuana will take them away from their harder drugs. We have seen this over and over again with opiate addicts. Opiate addicts who turn to methadone to get off or what's the other one? Suboxone. Those are the two drugs that get them off the opiates. They'll slip back. They'll slip back because they want that high and they're not getting the high from those two other drugs. Bring in cannabis, because they've already done research on this, and they will not go back to their opiates. They'll take an occasional hit off of a marijuana cigarette.
Yeah, you describe it as an exit drug rather than a gateway drug. An exit.
The doctors that are researching it are calling it the gateway to health. Because going back to this endocannabinoid system, our body does produce a little bit of cannabinoids, or we wouldn't have those keys and locks, okay? But we don't get enough. Why? Because this is the modern era, and we're not eating natural foods like we should be, and we're not getting beef that's been grass-fed, and all these different reasons of the way the modern world has dried us up when it comes to what we really need. So the cannabinoids can be added because we don't get enough, and that's when we feel better. However, back to the two ways.
Sudden setting.
If we can get past that, and the way a sitter can sit with somebody that starts to get anxiety, you know, they're thinking back of what, what's her name, Reagan told us about, you know, saying no to drugs. This is not a hard drug. It should have never been a Schedule I. That's all political. What you need is somebody for the first time, if you're going to try it, who is aware of it, who knows about it, who's probably tried it themselves. And if you start to get scared, they can tell you, it's okay, there's nothing to be scared of. This is what we call a safe other. Plus the fact we need to either be at home or somewhere where we feel really safe. So the setting is a safe place. And the set is also having some kind of a person with you where you have a healthy enough relationship that if you start to wander back into this is your brain on drugs, they can pull you out of that. Because it really is a very blissful experience if you've got the right set and setting.
Yeah. And it's possible to get really frightened when you take a psychedelic, and I would include cannabis in this. It's much milder than some of the other possibilities that are out there, and you start to realize, ooh, this is against the law. Ooh, there are people who, if they knew I was doing this now, they would throw me in prison or they would abuse me in various ways. That can get to be a really scary thought.
Right.
So I think, you know, there's some scary things about our culture, and that's reality.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The government wants to control us.
Yeah.
That's what scares me. I mean, we all know that this election that's coming up is huge, absolutely huge. And I know that the forefathers are turning over in their graves over what's going on right now. But part of it is becoming an individual independent of what we're being told. And I think that learning how to use cannabis in a state where it's legal is an appropriate way to get away from the prescription drugs that are really hurting us. And people are dying every day from prescription drugs. People are dying every day from alcohol consumption. There are no actual deaths from cannabis. Maybe a few where somebody was driving when they shouldn't have been because they were high. But there's no deaths from cannabis absorption into the body.
Yeah, a publisher just approached me to interview the author of a book that is diametrically opposed to everything that you're saying.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there's a lot of that too.
It was full of, and it was by a physician. I actually don't want to do that interview because I just don't believe it, you know, as somebody who's had some experience with these things. But it was like, talk about the whole thing was just a big scare thing. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. But a lot of these are being ghostwritten by people who are being hired by the pharmaceutical industry, including mm-hmm. the research. Many times, and they've caught them already, this is proof. There is proof that the pharmaceutical industry has a group that write their research, twist it around to what they want, and then actually pay physicians to put their names on those papers.
I do believe that. I mean, there's enough things have come to light, you know, now that it's quite believable that's the case. I wonder what we have not touched on here. We've definitely covered a lot of ground. Just looking at some of my notes here.
Well, while you're looking, if anybody's in the Vancouver, British Columbia area or wants to take a vacation there, I'm going to be speaking at a conference there July 9th and 10th at the Westin Bayshore Hotel. The name of the conference is Cannabis Hemp Conference. You know, hemp, there's a big movement for hemp, which is separate from cannabis. Cannabis is a drug. Hemp becomes cloth, rope, oil. I mean, you name it. Hemp has a lot of different uses. Our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution is written on hemp. Back in with our founding fathers, all the rope, all the sails were hemp for the boats. Hemp has a lot of wonderful uses and is much cheaper to make than the plastic industry would like us to know about.
Yeah.
So there is a conference, as I said, Cannabis Hemp Conference, July 9th and 10th.
I should keep that in mind. Vancouver is a delightful place to go. And I think I may have even stayed at that hotel once at a different professional conference. So it's a lovely area.
We're going 3 days early so we can sightsee in Vancouver.
Yeah, good for you. That's definitely the thing to do. Yeah. Well, I think you've really given us a good representation of what's in the book. And any other closing thoughts that come to mind?
Where do I begin? At the end of the book, I talk about 14 different triggers for having a spiritual experience.
14 different
Triggers to move into an alternate reality or just feel like you're connected to something bigger than we are. And I mean, it's childbirth and reading spiritual literature, hearing a spiritual talk, doing the 12 steps, psychedelics, close to death, helping somebody die. We've had spiritual experiences around the deathbed that can last a couple days. But what I want to say is if you use this as a wellness, the way I'm suggesting, if you use it to expand your mind, if you use it with the intention, with prayer, to ask it to help you open up, this can be a spiritual connection that has nothing to do with religion. Religion can still be there. I have nothing against religion. I love gathering with my kids and doing some kind of religious thing. But it can also be a direct connection spiritually. So honor that and try it, but don't try it if it's illegal in your state. I will say that. But open up to what God has planted on this planet.
Now that's a good wrap-up line right there.
So,
Yeah, Barbara Harris, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Sometimes Skype has an artifact which has a slight echo of my voice. I just didn't have the time and energy to hunt all those out and delete them. I hope you didn't find them too distracting in this interview or others to come. Listen with soft ears. I probably should say at the outset that neither Barbara Harris nor myself believe that marijuana is good for children or adolescents. And I need to be clear for myself that I'm not advocating marijuana for any medical or psychological condition. However, I do agree with Barbara that in states that allow medical marijuana, it's something that might be worth looking into and carefully experimenting with for one's own health. As you heard, I really agree with Barbara's suggestion that just a very small dose once or twice a day might be sufficient to meet one's needs, whatever they might be. Just that suggestion alone is enough to make me consider getting a California medical marijuana card. The situation here in California continues to be fairly paradoxical, I believe. People can legally consult with a physician to get a permission card to obtain medical marijuana from a dispensary. At the same time, however, the legality issue is not completely resolved vis-a-vis the federal government. And in the not-too-distant past, some dispensaries have been raided and closed down. I don't follow the situation closely, but I have the impression that there's still a certain amount of vagueness around the legal situation here. I've been open about the fact that from the mid-60s through the mid-70s, I smoked marijuana in social settings with friends and also experimented personally with other psychedelic substances. In part, it was a social, cultural current that I was swimming in, along with many other members of my generation. I also felt that as someone who was becoming a psychologist, that it was incumbent on me to explore these substances that were widely reported to open us up to new dimensions of consciousness, which indeed they did. I don't think I'd be nearly so open to the broad range of psychologies and personal reports that I explore today on this podcast, had I not had those experiences. In relation to her discussion on set and setting, Barbara Harris cites the work of Charles Tart. Tart is a few years older than I am, and his book on altered states of consciousness came out while I was still in my doctoral program at the University of Michigan. It had a profound impact on my thinking, and I reference his book liberally in my own dissertation on the altered states of meditation and hypnosis. It was my pleasure many years later to interview him here on Shrink Wrap Radio, and I would invite you to listen to episode number 34, 40 Years of Consciousness Research with Dr. Charles Tart. I'd also recommend other listening on this topic in episodes number 439, Psychedelics and Their Power to Heal with journalist, author Tom Schroeder, and episode number 283, An Update on the Positive Potential of Psychedelics with James Fadiman, Ph.D. You heard Barbara mention the acronym MAPS, M-A-P-S. She was referring to the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, which can be found at www.maps.org, where they state that they were founded in 1986, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies is a 501c nonprofit research and educational organization that develops medical, legal, and cultural contexts for people to benefit from the careful uses of psychedelics and marijuana. Obviously, this site is a key resource for any of you who wish to learn more about this topic. Of course, as always, if you want to get your own copy of The Secrets of Medical Marijuana by Barbara Harris, I encourage you to use our Amazon.com affiliate widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site. Similarly, you might use that to order any of her other 9 books there, written under her married name of Barbara Whitfield. There will be a transcript of this interview on our site, probably by the time you hear this or not long after. There will also be a full-length video of the interview on my Shrink Wrap Radio YouTube channel.
Hello, Dr. Dave and listeners of Shrink Wrap Radio. This is Paul Krause. I'm a licensed professional counselor in Tempe, Arizona. I decided to subscribe to donating $5 a month to Shrink Wrap Radio podcast. I like to take my friends out for coffee about once a month, and so I thought, why not take Dr. Dave out to coffee once a month? We've been spending so much time together via the podcast that I just wanted to show my appreciation. So I would encourage you all to think about it next time you're at a coffee shop. If you spend somewhere around $5, why not give Dr. Dave a $5 endorsement every month?
Why not indeed? Thanks for that very helpful suggestion, Paul Krause. Hey folks, if you don't do so already, how about taking me out to coffee? Or even a full course dinner? And I'm happy to report that we do have some new donors. My sincere thanks go out to Sylvie Barut, who renewed her annual commitment, Simon Huggins, who did something similar, and Prometheus Family Support. One of the things I'm most proud of about Shrink Wrap Radio is the fact that for some time now, we've been able to offer continuing education credits for professional licensure. We've got over 100 CE units based on my interviews with psychological professionals. However, there is additional work required over and above my conducting the interviews. There's written work that I'm just not feeling up to these days. So you haven't seen any new courses from me for some time. I'm looking for a psychological professional willing to do occasional work for relatively low pay. Yes, I did say pay, but pretty low pay. I need someone who can produce the written components of my Zur Institute CE courses. We haven't put up a new CE course in quite some time because the person Zur hired to handle the written parts of the courses has moved on to other things. I did it at first, and then I found it burdensome. They hired somebody else to do it, and now that person's moved on. Now, each CE-worthy course needs to have 10 true or false questions per unit hour. So, for example, a 6-unit course would need 60 true-false questions. Beyond this, there needs to be a couple of paragraphs describing the course with a number of bullet points highlighting the key benefits of the course, and there needs to be a course syllabus. There's also a bit more writing. The person who is hired will have access to samples from past courses and consultation via phone and email with the key staff person at the Zur Institute. The writing needs to be up to APA standards, and that's why you need to be a seasoned professional. At the same time, it needs to be engaging. You need to listen to the course interviews, of course, so that you can write about them. You need to be reliable and keep your commitments. In the past, the Zur Institute has paid in the range of United States dollars between $400 and $600 for this work, depending upon the number of units in a given course. So if this sounds like you, if this is something you'd like to help with, please contact me at shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, or you can call me at 707-585-7363. If you have the qualifications and interest. You may have noticed at the beginning of this episode that we have a new sponsor, Zipcar. You know, from an environmental point of view, this is a car sharing service that makes a lot of sense to me. Here's a little background on them. Founded in 2000, Zipcar operates the world's leading car sharing network. Zipwork provides the freedom of wheels when you want them, to its members known as Zipsters, giving them a convenient, cost-effective, and enjoyable alternative to car ownership. Zipcar's self-service vehicles are available on demand in conveniently located reserved parking spots in neighborhoods where the members live and work. Members can receive cars by the hour or by the day at rates that include gas, insurance, and other costs associated with car ownership. The company operates a fleet of vehicles in over 500 cities and towns and more than 500 college campuses and more than 50 airports throughout Austria, Canada, France, Spain, Turkey, the United Kingdom, and, of course, the United States. You can earn $25 of free driving credit at www.joinzipcar.com/shrinkwrapradio or by clicking on the banner ad in our left-hand sidebar. And I'll tell you more about Zipcar in future episodes. You know, I like to help folks when I can. I was contacted by some young folks who have written an Android app that has an underlying psychological principle. So I offered to give them a bit of free promotion here. The app is called Kick Clock, and here's how they describe it. Kick Clock is a new alarm clock app for Android that aims to use the principles of classical conditioning to help users kick bad habits. A user begins by uploading a photo of their vice, a cigarette, a candy bar, even an ex-lover. And when the alarm sounds in the morning, they are confronted with that photo, on top of which is a moving off or snooze button that they must hit to silence the alarm. Over time, the brain begins to associate the uploaded image with the very unpleasant sensation of being woken up in the morning. If you've ever used a favorite song as your alarm, you probably know how easy it is to develop an aversion to anything associated with waking up. The developers of this app are now looking for help making the app better and are asking any Android users to download the app, which is free, play around with it, and send feedback via their website, which is kickclockapp.com. That's kickclockapp.com. You can also find a link to download the app on the website, or you can search for Kick Clock on the Google Play Store. So I hope you will take advantage of that free opportunity and see whether or not it makes psychological sense to you, if the idea holds water, and give them some feedback. Finally, coming back to those CE units through the Zur Institute, let me remind you that you can get a 10% discount off on any of their courses or course materials using the code DRDAVE88. That's just DRDAVE88 at ZurInstitute.com. That's not just my courses, but all of their courses.
Hi, this is dream analyst and author Jane Teresa Anderson in Brisbane, Australia, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, dream analyst Jane Teresa Anderson, who was my guest on episode number 226 back in 2009. It's a delightful interview if you haven't heard it. Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Vicky, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. Firstly, congratulations on 500 episodes. It's been my regular listen on my walk to work every Monday for a couple of years now. I feel very lucky to have found it. Episode 503 with Dr. Kinderman was especially good, critical, down-to-earth, and humane. I've since looked him up and will be following his work online. I'd be happy to transcribe it if nobody else is. Please advise on the layout, etc. Thank you again for this fantastic resource," and that's from Vicky. And Vicky, thanks so much for letting me know, for your congratulations on 500 episodes, first of all, and also for letting me know that you are a longtime and regular listener, and for stepping forward to be a transcriber for that particular interview. Next, we hear from Simon, who writes, "I left a comment on Facebook about a recent episode, and I never did congratulate you on your 500 episodes and still going. Seems unreal given the quality of your guests. Thank you again for providing such a consistently stimulating assortment of guests. I really never know what to expect next, and even when some of the guests are a little more difficult to keep on track, you do a remarkable job in gently coaxing them back. A real masterclass in interviewing. All the best." And that's from Simon. And Simon, thank you. That's really heartwarming for me to hear. And I appreciate your congratulations. And I hope to keep surprising you. I've still got some tricks up my sleeve. I want to let you know. And finally, we hear from Lucy, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Just a shout out from Sydney, Australia. I'm currently studying behavioral psychology with an ultimate goal of becoming a clinical psychologist. I had experience with anxiety in my early 20s, and what I learned through the course of my therapy has genuinely changed my life. In listening to your podcasts, I not only appreciate it from a student's perspective, but also from a personal one. The various disciplines are fascinating. I enjoy listening to the differing perspectives. In saying that, though, I feel a very strong connection to the Jungian methodology and to ISTDP, and I am actively researching these areas to learn more about them. I have sent through a small donation as a token of my thanks for such an informative podcast. I wish I could do more, but balancing family life and university can be challenging. On a side note, I would love to hear a show on the physiology behind depression. To give you an example, I know a man who is taking Tegretol after having a brain tumor removed, located near the lateral prefrontal cortex. He's thankfully gone 10 years without complications except for depression. He stopped taking Tegretol as the risk of seizure had passed. What was not known at the time was that Tegretol is also prescribed as a mood stabilizer. When he stopped taking this medication, his depressive episodes became more complex and prolonged. What I'm getting at is this: what part does chemical imbalance play, and can depression be a symptom of a physiological issue? I know the suggestion of chemical imbalance is a highly contentious issue, and to date, not one that we are able to test for in any effective manner. Your thoughts would be of great interest. Keep up the great work, and thank you again." And that's from Lucy in Sydney, Australia. And I did reply to Lucy, pointing her to a few past interviews on depression and also on diet supplementation, etc. So I think that will have at least given her a start on the questions that she's raising, and I'll continue to keep those questions in mind as we move along. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. As always, you can send emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail using our app or at our message phone, 415-830-4014. Thanks to today's guest, Barbara Harris, for her insights into the uses of medicinal marijuana and for sharing her very personal spiritual journey resulting from her near-death experiences. My next interview will feature Jungian psychotherapist Dr. Mary Harrell. We'll be discussing her recent book, Imaginal Figures in Everyday Life: Stories from the World Between Matter and Mind. It's a beautifully written book, and all you Jungian fans are in for a real treat. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.